The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis with Guardian Weekly, news and views from The Guardian's team of international reporters and commentators. This week, another setback to efforts to bring peace to the Middle East.
The situation is extremely dangerous, unprecedented in terms of the death toll.
Many Israeli analysts are now saying that there are really only two options, both of them most unpalatable.
A crucial moment in the race for the White House, especially crucial for Hillary Clinton.
A few weeks ago, she was well ahead in Ohio and Texas, and then those poll leads evaporated. People were writing her off.
And was the state visit to Iraq by the Iranian president a propaganda coup for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad? Or does it represent a fresh start after years of tension?
He loves playing the populist and being revered by the wider Islamic public, and he is a very high stock across the Islamic and Arab world, and this can only increase it.
You are not out of the danger zone, particularly in view of the statements made to this effect by senior Israeli officials.
More than 100 Palestinians and three Israelis were killed last week in fighting between Israeli troops and the Islamist movement Hamas. After 5 days of intense combat in Gaza, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert withdrew his tanks on Monday. Mr. Olmert aims to weaken Hamas and is warned of more fighting soon. But Hamas has claimed victory. Its militants are continuing their rocket attacks on Israeli border towns. Our Middle East correspondent Rory McCarthy is in Jerusalem. Rory, is the Israeli operation in Gaza over the last few days really just been a dress rehearsal for a much larger military campaign?
I fear that it has. In many ways, it was not a one-off operation. There have been a series of operations going on over many months in Gaza. This represented by far the largest. The casualty toll was far larger than anything we've seen in the Palestinian territories for 7 or 8 years. But all the indications are from the Israeli government that they are planning and preparing for a much bigger operation. And that's because the rockets haven't stopped. And as far as the Israeli government is concerned, this is unacceptable and has to be dealt with military force.
I mean, has this military action in Gaza gone any way towards stopping the rocket attacks, though?
Well, I mean, here is the ultimate dilemma. For 5 days, there was a very intense series of military operations, which, as you correctly said, killed more than 100 Palestinians, of whom we believe at least half were civilians. There were also 3 Israelis killed, 2 soldiers and a civilian. And yet, the rockets were still being fired, even at the end of that operation. So, on the surface, no. And that's been the evidence of previous operations in the past as well. I mean, in 2006, there were a series of very tough Israeli military operations over several months in Gaza. 400 Palestinians were killed, and that did not stop the rockets either. This is Israel's great dilemma. What do they do about these rockets? Many Israeli analysts are now saying that there are really only two options, both of them most unpalatable. The first would be a major military occupation of the Gaza Strip, which would require thousands and thousands of Israeli soldiers and would cost the lives of many Israeli soldiers and of even more Palestinians, both militants and almost certainly civilians too. The other alternative is to negotiate with Hamas, and the Israeli government says as long as Hamas refuses to recognize Israel and to give up violence, there will be no negotiations.
The Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas has withdrawn from the current peace talks in protest at the offensive in Gaza. But really, I suppose his influence on the Israelis or on Hamas is limited.
That's very true. His influence on Hamas is extremely limited. And he finds himself in a very difficult position. His whole policy platform that he's offered to the Palestinian people is one of negotiation. For many years in the past, his party, Fatah, was a party of armed resistance. That's changed. However, when you have such big operations which claim the lives of so many Palestinians, he cannot be seen to be talking to the Israelis and still expect support from the Palestinian people. So he had to suspend talks at the moment. I suspect eventually he'll go back to the negotiating table, but not much is being accomplished. The whole point about these negotiations, what the West has been talking about and what Israel too has been saying, they regard Abu Mazen as a moderate leader. He's based in the West Bank, which is where his power is. They hoped that the negotiations could produce some concrete changes on the ground in the West Bank that would convince the Palestinians that the path to negotiations was the right path by sticking with the talks. They could see some genuine gains, something real on the ground. And that would distinguish them from the situation in Gaza, which is under the control of Hamas and where quite clearly there are no obvious improvements at the moment. However, this just hasn't worked. There just hasn't been any significant change on the ground in the West Bank. The settlements are still there. Even the most distant settlements known as the illegal outposts, which Israel had committed to take down, have not come down. About 560 checkpoints are still across the West Bank, which make it very difficult for Palestinians to move even within the West Bank, let alone between the West Bank and Israel. From the Israelis' point of view, they argue the Palestinians haven't done enough to control security, to impose law and order in the West Bank. And so there hasn't been this hoped-for gain on the ground, and therefore there hasn't been this sense of progress at all.
Rory, many thanks. It was trailed as Super Tuesday 2, crucial primary elections in Texas and Ohio that would decide whether Hillary Clinton remained in the race to be the Democratic presidential candidate for the White House. Her rival, Barack Obama, had won the last 11 primary elections, and Clinton had seen her lead in the polls eroded to the point of a dead heat. But Clinton gave it everything she got over the last week. Ewan McCaskill's in Texas for The Guardian. But first, let's hear from Suzanne Goldenberg in Ohio.
What turned out to be a really good night for Hillary Clinton started right here in Ohio. She won a big victory in this state, more than 12 points over Barack Obama, and that provides an important psychological boost for Clinton after losing the last 12 contests in a row. And she came out in her speech to supporters tonight portraying this victory almost as a redemption for a campaign that had been written off for dead. She started her speech by saying that this win was for everybody who'd been knocked down but not knocked out of a race, for anybody who's been disappointed or stumbled, that there was a possibility of a comeback. The ingredients for her victory here in Ohio really seem to have come together in the last days, indeed hours of the campaign. She seems to have really convinced voters that she was better equipped to deal with issues of national security and of the economy. Now, the economy is a really important issue here in Ohio. More than a quarter of a million people have lost their jobs since 2000. Manufacturing has really fled the state. Exit polls showed that three-quarters of families were really concerned about their economic future. Hillary Clinton was really successful in tapping in to that sentiment on the ground, and she won overwhelmingly among her core constituents. So she managed to reassemble her coalition. She got the votes of white men and women, as well as low-income voters. And that put her in over the top in Ohio, and her campaign, would argue, could carry her forward in the contests ahead.
This nation's coming back, and so is this campaign.
This is a sensational result for her. She had to take either Ohio or Texas to show that she was still a contender, and she took both. She took Ohio by quite a large margin, which is important for her in terms of delegates. Texas was closely fought, but she came out on top in the end. If she hadn't won, there'd be heavy pressure on her from the Democratic Party saying, look, if you make this a protracted contest, you can't win it, better to get out so Obama can get on and fight McCain. But by winning Texas and Ohio, she's turned all that in its head. She's as much of a claim to be the nominee as Obama has now. A few weeks ago, she was well ahead in Ohio and Texas, and then those poll leads evaporated. People were writing her off. But then over the last week, she's mounted a fantastically aggressive campaign. You can hardly move as a journalist over the last week without receiving an email or a call or a press conference from Clinton's people. They've hammered Obama on national security. There was an advert put out that played in Texas and Ohio, a sort of scare advert about national security, about a phone ringing in the White House at 3 a.m. Who would you want to answer it? The implication being that Barack Obama wasn't up to the job. Her team have hit him over his connections with Tony Rezko, a Chicago businessman whose trial for alleged corruption began today. All these things, plus arguments about the economy and trade agreement, he was just on the receiving end of a battering for day after day, and it's worked. Her tactics have paid off. Although delegates are distributed on the basis of a complicated PR system, and Obama himself said, look, as a result of these victories, nothing has changed. I will still have a lead. And it's even possible under the sort of complicated caucus system they have in Texas for distributing delegates that Obama could, it's even conceivably, could end up with more.
Mediator Kofi Annan now walking to the table where that signing ceremony will take place.
We've had a very constructive and fruitful day. We've come to an understanding on the coalition agreement. In all successful negotiations, there is give and take. Invariably, some supporters on each side feel that their negotiators gave too much. To those people in Kenya, I would say this: compromise was necessary for the survival of this country. Support this agreement, for it is the key to the unity of Kenya.
On Thursday, Kenya's MPs are expected to pass a constitutional amendment that will allow a coalition government to be led by President Mwai Kibaki, with his opposition rival Raila Odinga taking the new post of Prime Minister. Zan Rice is The Guardian's correspondent in Nairobi. Zan, there must be enormous relief that Kenya's leaders have reached this agreement.
There is, because it was largely unexpected, John. The violence had gone on for several weeks, and although it had abated slightly, there were no indications that President Mwai Kibaki was willing to compromise. So there is enormous relief among the business community, but especially among the ordinary people who were affected by the violence.
How did Kofi Annan manage to pull this off?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, just earlier last week, he had lost his temper with the negotiating teams and said that he wasn't going to speak to them anymore and that he was going to speak directly to the leaders. And at that stage, the idea of them coming to an agreement quickly looked pretty far-fetched. One aspect which quite a few people have pointed to is the presence of Tanzanian president and the current African Union chairman, Jakaya Kikwete, who came into Kenya to assist Annan, and 2 days later there was an agreement. Quite what magic he brought to the table, nobody is exactly sure, but his presence certainly seemed to have some effect, and he is on fairly good terms with Kibaki. His presence may have led to the deal.
And has this deal ended the violence?
It has. I mean, there was some violence yesterday in the Mount Elgon region, but that saw a lot of violence even before the election, and it goes back to land disputes. So I don't think anyone's suggesting that this is tied up to the current crisis.
And how much damage has the turmoil done to Kenya's economy?
It's done huge damage to the economy, and most analysts and economists here say it will take possibly years to recover. Tourism, the main foreign exchange earner, has almost completely dropped off, about 90% down. The agricultural exports, tea, coffee, vegetables, flowers, have all been seriously hit. So the damage to the economy was severe.
And a downturn in Kenya's economy presumably has a knock-on effect on the whole region.
Well, that's right. I mean, Kenya is the gateway to Uganda and Rwanda, to South Sudan, to parts of Democratic Republic of Congo. So they were all suffering heavily. And their leaders were particularly keen to see the crisis ended. And while they were quite cautious in some of their comments, there certainly was pressure from them on the leaders on both sides in Kenya to find some sort of solution.
300,000 people were left homeless in this year's violence. What's happened to them?
A lot of them have gone to stay with family members. The government was actually assisting a lot of people in going back to what they call the ancestral areas. And that's, you know, a family living in Nairobi may have gone back all the way to Western Kenya if they were from the Luo ethnic group, for example, who mainly live in Western Kenya. By the same token, a Kikuyu family in the Rift Valley may have gone and stayed with their relatives in Central Kenya, where most Kikuyus live. There's also still a lot of people in displaced persons camps, and some people sheltering still in church grounds, police stations, etc. So they spread out all over. And the big question is, are they ever going to go back home? Because some of them are so traumatised and they've lost everything that they may decide to stay behind wherever they've now relocated to.
Zan, many thanks.
Pleasure, John.
Chorro, el presidente Uribe y la oligarquía colombiana que nos vengan a dividir, que nos vengan a debilitar. No lo vamos a permitir.
I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Weekly. Tensions between South American neighbours threatened to escalate into violent conflict this week. First, Colombian troops battling Marxist guerrillas entered Ecuador to kill a FARC commander. This prompted Hugo Chavez to close Venezuela's embassy in Bogota and to send 10 battalions of troops to the Colombian border. Then Ecuador severed its diplomatic ties with Colombia, and Colombia says it wants to get Chavez prosecuted by the International Criminal Court for financing terrorists. Rory Carroll's our Latin American correspondent. Rory, what are the links between Chavez and FARC?
Well, a certain ideological affinity. They both share a passion for Simon Bolivar, the 19th century liberation hero, and certainly they share a leftist view of the world in which they view that the United States is an imperialist force and that oligarchies control economies across the region. And so Chavez has become increasingly explicit in expressing sympathies for the objectives of the FARC. So certainly there's that. But then the Colombian authorities go further and they say that he's actually hosting, or at least turning a blind eye to FARC bases just inside the Venezuelan border with Colombia.
And there's been a long history of tension between Venezuela and Colombia, and both countries have ramped up their military spending in recent years. But is this really just saber-rattling by Hugo Chavez?
I think for the moment it is just saber-rattling. I mean, for instance, since he made his dramatic announcement, we've actually seen very, very little mobilizations of these tank battalions. I think he wanted to escalate tension, which he's certainly done, and send a very blunt warning to the Colombians. So, yes, it is saber-rattling for the moment, but it is still a very combustible situation because you have pretty much a hot war, which is the war within Colombia between the government and the FARC rebels, and very kind of angry and nervous neighbors who are themselves also armed and who are now looking to see what's going to happen next.
Is the Colombian government winning its decades-long war with FARC?
Well, certainly it's had some crushing successes over the past few years. What we've seen is the FARC have been pushed out of the cities, meaning that Bogota and Cali and these cities which were notorious in the 90s have now become extremely safe by Latin American standards. And actually the FARC have been pushed deeper and deeper into the jungles and into these border areas where they're seeking refuge from what is now a much more powerful Colombian army. And of course it's more powerful because it's being funded by the United States. It gets billions of dollars worth of training and top-of-the-range equipment. So that what we've seen in the last few years are mid-ranking and now senior FARC commanders being killed, and also we've been seeing a steady stream of defections from the FARC. From about 17,000 fighters just a few years ago, they're now down to around an estimated 11,000.
How has the Colombian government managed to persuade FARC guerrillas to defect?
Well, by saying that they're onto a no-winner. They're saying, look, you know, look where this is going. You guys are being pushed back into the jungle. You're not going to topple the state. That your leaders are aging. And Marulanda, the leader of the FARC, has been doing this for over half a century. And so they're saying, basically, the FARC have turned from what was originally a peasant army with a strong ideological component, a Marxist component, has now become like a narco-terrorist outfit, which has increasingly got very little legitimacy because the Colombian government is actually rather popular, and President Alvaro Uribe's hardline crackdown on the FARC has actually won him a lot of popularity, and he's actually one of the most popular leaders in terms of approval ratings in the region.
Rory Carroll in Caracas. I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Weekly. Still to come, Iraq rolls out the red carpet for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
I think to get any grasp of Iran's attitude towards Iraq, you really have to go back to the eight-year war the two countries fought against each other in the 1980s. Iran to this day is very heavily scarred by that experience, and when you consider the role that Iran is playing in Iraq at the moment, it really has to be seen in that light.
And a general election in Spain this weekend. The current Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, faces accusations that he's weak on the economy and Basque separatism.
For the right wing, the idea of the breakup of the Spanish state is a particularly important topic. We've seen a number of arrests and moves against the political parties which are supportive of ETA.
But first, Jim Falzerano's here with a look at this week's Guardian Weekly. This is the print edition. And Jim, of course, a former presenter of this very podcast.
Indeed. And I'd like to welcome you to the good ship Guardian Weekly, by the way.
Excellent. Many thanks, Jim. I'll treasure that moment. And on the front of this week's Guardian Weekly, a terrible tale, actually, by Rory McCarthy, who we've just been hearing from, about how a 12-year-old girl came to die in her father's arms.
Yes. I mean, he's basically reporting on the Israeli assault on Gaza through the lens of this particular death, and it's quite a moving story.
And Simon Tisdall gives his world briefing this week on China's approach to Taiwan.
Yes, rather than the usual saber-rattling, China's learning that soft power can be very effective in handling Taiwan.
And the actor Simon Callow reviews a book about Mr. Shufflewick.
Oh, the amazing Mrs. Shufflewick,
actually.
Oh, I'm actually.
Sorry.
No. Well, you're actually half right, because it's the amazing Mrs. Shufflewick, also known as Rex Jameson.
Well, many thanks, Jim. And don't forget, if you want 4 free copies of the Guardian Weekly print edition, you can subscribe by going to guardianweekly.co.uk. This week, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad became the first Iranian president to visit neighbouring Iraq since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It was also the first state visit to Iraq by any foreign head of state since the US-led coalition overthrew Saddam Hussein 5 years ago. 1 million people died in the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, but President Ahmadinejad promised a new chapter in relations with Iraq, despite the presence there of 150,000 American troops. Robert Tate was until recently The Guardian's correspondent in Tehran. Robert, how significant was Ahmadinejad's visit to Iraq?
Symbolically, I think it was very important, and it was one more opportunity for President Ahmadinejad to give America a poke in the eye with a stick, because for the past 2 or 3 years, as we know, the Bush administration have been accusing Iran of meddling in Iraqi affairs and being responsible for a great deal of the insurgency and instability that's taking place in Iraq. Now, President Ahmadinejad has now been received really welcomed with open arms by the Iraqi government. So that really is, in a sense, giving, from his perspective and from many other people's perspective, giving a lie to the American claims and accusations.
And a big contrast with the visits to Iraq by George Bush. He could only stay for a few hours at a remote airbase. There's Ahmadinejad, getting the red carpet treatment.
For sure. I mean, he loves all this stuff. He loves the whole aspect of playing the populist and being revered by the wider Islamic public. And he is a very high stock across the Islamic and Arab world, and this can only increase it.
Although Iraq's Sunni community weren't very happy with the Iranian president's visit, and there were some protests in Sunni areas of Iraq.
That's inevitable, considering that Iran is a Shiite country and the level of sectarian and internecine violence we've seen in Iraq. It's not something that is of any great domestic significance for Mr. Ahmadinejad, since the Sunni population in Iran is comparatively small, less than 10%.
Iran's accused by the US of backing Shia militias in Iraq. But does Iran want a stable Iraq?
Absolutely. You know, I think to get any grasp of Iran's attitude towards Iraq, you really have to go back to the 8-year war the two countries fought against each other in the 1980s. Iran to this day is very heavily scarred by that experience, and when you consider the role that Iran is playing in Iraq at the moment, it really has to be seen in that light. The Iranians consider that they have very legitimate security concerns in Iraq, and that what they wish for above all else is a stable Iraq. Even more important than that, that is friendly to Tehran. And, of course, it is in Iran's national interests for the Shia majority in Iraq to be playing the dominant role there.
To have Iraq as a viable trading partner as well.
A viable trading partner, which it already is. I mean, there's a great deal of trade taking place between Iran and Iraq at the moment. I think there's a definite element of ambivalence of the Iranian feeling towards the American engagement there. On the one hand, they don't like Americans being there because their great enemy is on their doorstep. On the other hand, while they're in that situation, they are Americans are thrown off balance. They would like a stable, friendly Iraq. On the other hand, they like to see America getting a bloody nose.
In December, a major US intelligence report said that Iran had scrapped its nuclear weapons program as long ago as 2003. Then last month, the International Atomic Energy Agency said US intelligence had showed that nuclear weapons technology was being developed by Iran. Is it possible, Robert, to determine what is going on?
Concerning that specific report, I happen to know that many people within the US diplomatic community were very unhappy with the way it was worded and felt that, while factually correct, the US diplomatically does not feel that that's the end of the matter. However, the way the report was presented in the international media was undoubtedly a great coup for Iran, and it has made Mr. Ahmadinejad coming up smelling of roses.
This week, the UN Security Council backed fresh sanctions against Iran for its failure to comply with UN resolutions to halt uranium enrichment. Do we know what the reaction has been in Iran to this international pressure?
Well, they have condemned the latest resolution out of hand, and they've been doing that even before it was actually passed. These sanctions contained in the resolution are very much symbolic. I mean, I think they really only go as far as strengthening existing sanctions. Iran has said all along that they will not suspend the uranium enrichment program, no matter what sanctions are imposed on them. If you speak to businessmen in Iran, what is hurting them is not the sanctions that are being passed by the UN Security Council, but it's a psychological ripple effect throughout the business world, and they find it very hard to get letters of credit. They sometimes find that large monetary transactions are blocked, even by international financial institutions that are not subject to the sanctions.
And we're going to have a new US president in the White House this time next year, of course. And the current US Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, says he's opposed to a US military assault on Iran. Do you think we're going to see a warming up of relations over the next few years?
I wouldn't go that far. You know, the precedent of the last 29 years is not promising. What we've seen is 20 years of glacial relations. There's nothing to suggest that that's going to stop in the foreseeable future. In a sense, it depends who the new president is. No, if we were to see President McCain in the White House, the conventional wisdom would be that on the basis of Nixon, who's the only man who could go to China, that maybe a man with John McCain's hawkish credentials would find it easier to open up to Iran. If we're going to see, on the other hand, a liberal Democrat such as Barack Obama, well, it may be more difficult for him. And you know, we don't know how Iran would react to a man whose middle name is apparently Hussein. You know, this would be another confusing element in the equation.
Robert, many thanks. Oxfam aims to alleviate poverty and injustice. It has an annual global expenditure of $1 billion and is active in more than 100 countries. Earlier this week, Barbara Stocking, head of Oxfam UK, talked to Guardian Weekly's Charlotte Thompson about her charity's attempts to reinvent the role of an NGO for the 21st century.
After the tsunami struck, Oxfam was one of the agencies who stuck its head above the parapet and said, we do need to be working across agencies more. And you called for massively increased coordination between all the NGOs. How have things moved on since then?
Oh, well, enormously. I think the tsunami was an unusual one. It was so huge, and it brought out such a strong public response and reaction, which was very positive. But what that also meant was every NGO in the world wanted to be there. Now, that was difficult in the first few months. After about 6 months, of course, most agencies had gone, apart from those who are the long-serving, if you like. And so it calmed down quite considerably, and the coordination became much easier amongst the agencies that were there. And the government structures got into place to handle them too.
In fact, it seems in many ways it was a wake-up call to the agencies of how they can work together.
Yes, though I think there are about 9 or 10 global agencies who provide something like 80% of the emergency response around the world. Now, there are a lot more smaller agencies who came in because of the tsunami. But, of course, in places like Sudan, Darfur, you don't find them there anyway. So there is a tradition of working together, working with the UN in coordination. But I think just the tsunami, so many agencies came in, it was just overwhelming, really.
Yes.
Barbara Stocking. And you can hear a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/audio. The people of Spain vote in a general election next weekend. The main campaign issues for Sunday's election have been the economy, immigration and Basque separatism. Throughout the campaign, the Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero and his socialists have remained slightly ahead of the opposition leader Mariano Rajoy of the Popular Party. Paul Hamelos is in Madrid for The Guardian. Paul, what are the polls saying?
Well, for the last few months, they've shown that the socialists of Zapatero are between 2 and 5 points ahead of the right-wing People's Party led by Mariano Rajoy. It looks like Zapatero is going to get back in for a second four-year term in the elections on March 9th.
What have been the successes of the last 4 years for the incumbent Prime Minister?
Well, Zapatero is very much the socially progressive, modern European Democrat. He's introduced legalisation of gay marriage, an express divorce law. He's brought in some gender equality legislation. And he's also held an amnesty for illegal immigrants already working in the country. Probably the most controversial bit of legislation was what's known as the historical memory law, which attempts to redress some of the grievances of the family members of victims of Franco's forces in the Civil War, which was widely criticised on the right in the country for unnecessarily reopening old wounds, but supported by those, obviously, who lost family members on the left.
And what have been the main lines of attack for the opposition leader Mariano Rajoy?
Well, it's very interesting, actually. This has become the real kind of political hot topic. It's the economy. After 4 years in which Rajoy has mostly concentrated on terrorism and immigration and other things, the economy has been his big sort of stick to beat Zapatero with. Because in recent times, we've seen a bit of a downturn in a previously booming economy, you know, hit by the global credit squeeze. We've seen unemployment rising. The construction industry is struggling and inflation is at a 12-year high.
And what about the issue of Basque separatism? Because that's also played a major part in this campaign.
Well, indeed. And for the right wing, the idea of the breakup of the Spanish state is a particularly important topic. So we've seen a number of arrests and moves against the political parties which are supportive of Basque separatism, and some of which are accused of being in alliance with ETA, which has been a part of a campaign by the socialists to look tough on Basque separatism ahead of the elections and therefore take the ground away from the right wing. But what has happened is something that Rajoy has really made a big play about, was that at the end of last year, beginning of this year, Zapatero admitted that he had held negotiations with ETA. This was even after the ceasefire was broken in December 2006 when ETA carried out an attack on Madrid's Barajas airport in which two Ecuadorians were killed. And that has been something that Rajoy has made a big play of, saying that, you know, Zapatero had lied to the Spanish people and should not be negotiating with terrorists. Obviously, what happened last time was that the then government of José María Aznar said in the immediate aftermath of the Madrid bomb attacks that ETA was responsible, despite evidence to the contrary that it was in fact North African Islamist militants. And this brought out this huge turnout in protest of perceived manipulation, which took the victory for the socialists. This time we've seen such a big split between the right and left that it is possible that there will be a high turnout, but I find it hard to believe it will be quite as high as it was last time.
And a high turnout, of course, would favour the socialists.
It certainly would. In fact, it's been one of the right-wing PP's campaign strategies, is to discourage uncertain socialist voters from actually turning out for the socialists and thereby ensuring a low turnout which favours the right wing.
Paul Hamelos in Madrid, many thanks. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening to this week's programme, which was produced by Matt Hayward.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.